You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Fourteen years ago, I was teaching third grade in Dallas, Texas, and one of the assignments they had for the reading was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. And, it was my first year of teaching. I would just assign chapters and blocks, not paying attention to which chapters they were. And I happened to assign one week to read up through one of the chapters about the death of Aslan. And Aslan, as you know, is the Christ figure in the story. He's the great lion. Well, let me just read to you what my students read Sunday night before they showed up at class on Monday morning. This is the end of that chapter. When once Aslan had been tied, and tied so that he was really a mass of cords, on the flat stone, a hush fell on the crowd. Four hags, holding four torches, stood at the corners of the table. The witch bared her arms as she had bared them the previous night, when it had been Edmund instead of Aslan. At last she drew near. She stood by Aslan's head. Her face was working and twitching with passion. But his looked up at the sky, still quiet, neither angry nor afraid, but a little sad. Then, just before she gave the blow, she stooped down and said in a quivering voice, "Now who has won? Fool, did you think that by all this you would save the human traitor? Now I will kill you instead of him, as our pact was, and so the deep magic will be appeased. But when you're dead, what will prevent me from killing him as well? And who will take him out of my hand then? Understand that you have given me Narnia forever. You have lost your own life, and you have not saved his. In that knowledge, despair and die." The children did not see the actual moment of the killing. They couldn't bear to look and covered their eyes. Thus ends the reading assignment from Mr. Walker. I had a little girl in the class named Ashley. She was a good girl. She followed the rules. She did not read past that. And I had come in early on a Monday morning, about a half an hour before the children were to come. And right after I got there, Ashley came to the door of the classroom and stood there. And her face was quivering, and she was about to cry. And I said, "Ashley, what's wrong?" And she said, "They killed Aslan, Mr. Walker." And I said, "Did you not read further?" She said, "No." I said, "Come here." I said, "Sit down and just keep reading." And I sat down at my desk and just watched Ashley read. And as she read, her eyes began to light up, and she got this little innocent smile across her face, and the tears that had dried cracks in her face began to go away. She was discovering the joy of resurrection firsthand. It's a kind of joy that is really hard to get back in adulthood. In adulthood, we lose this kind of joy because, you know, we know stuff. We know the story. But I would like to suggest that our task today, as it is every day, is not simply to remember the story of the resurrection, but to live it. Paul said in Romans 6 that we have been buried with Christ into death, so that just as he was raised from the dead, so we too might walk in newness of life. This is not just some story that we remember, that we commemorate in some way once a year. This is our story. We are in Christ, raised with him to new life. That's why we anticipate this day so much. That's why we dress up. That's why we fill our day with worship and family and friends and food and gifts, because this is a glorious day. We should celebrate. Although on that first Easter, the first Sunday after Jesus died, that was not the scene. The tone was not one of singing and celebration. It was quite a different scene altogether. The first people that came to the empty tomb and the community of friends that they did life with were afraid. There were lots of reactions noted in the accounts, but the most often noted emotion among those in that first day was fear. Their first inclination on the empty tomb was not to put on pastels and to sing, "Christ the Lord is risen today." Not at all. They were terrified. Look how Mark ends his account of Jesus' resurrection. Verse 8. And they, the women, went out, having seen the empty tomb, having heard from the angel, went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And Mark's gospel ends there. I know you have some more verses, but if you'll read your little note there, the early manuscripts of Mark end there. People added later an ending because they didn't like this ending. They didn't like indie films. They wanted it to resolve. Okay? But I think Mark is communicating something about the tone of discovery in the resurrection. For Ashley, it was joy. For the women at the tomb, fear. And as I've been reading this text this week, I've been thinking about how fear dominates these narratives. And it's made me wonder if the reason that we have such a hard time recapturing that joy isn't just because of familiarity, but also because of fear. Though we know the story, are still so governed by fear. We're afraid of the unknown. We're afraid of what people will think of us. We're afraid of our inadequacy, that we might fail. We're afraid of death, some of us. The resurrection addresses these fears, our deepest fears. And if we will today just be honest for a moment about our fears, and let the resurrection speak into it, I think that we'll be able to enter the narrative of this first Easter in such a way that it would speak to us anew, that we would recapture somehow the joy of a third grader discovering that Aslan has risen from the dead. Into our fear of the unknown, the resurrection speaks an assurance to us. Into our fear of rejection, the resurrection speaks a word of grace to us. And into our fear of inadequacy, the resurrection brings unthinkable power to our lives. All right, so let's first talk about our fear of the unknown. When it comes to the resurrection, the unknown is precisely the subject of the debate. From the first century, even in Paul's letters, all the way till our day on Time magazine and everywhere in between, the historical event of Jesus' resurrection is much debated, much talked about, very controversial. And the reason that it hasn't gone away and that it will likely never go away is because there's so much at stake in the debate. Like, you could concede any number of historical arguments about any number of historical events without cramping your lifestyle at all. But one cannot say that Jesus of Nazareth has risen from the dead and then just get on with his life as usual. There's a lot at stake. That's why it's so hotly contested. And both sides have their fears. On one side, there is a fear of those who believe, and the fear is, what if it's not really true? I mean, that question crosses my mind sometimes. Random times, I'll be just thinking, what if this all isn't really true? Like, what if it's just a good lifestyle that people choose, and that's fine, but in the end, we'll just find out that we spent all this time and money and energy for something that wasn't true. I could have watched more TV. I could have done something else with my time. That's kind of an unsettling question for your pastor to ask, I'm sure. But I think if you're honest, you've asked that question too, or questions like it. And so let's be honest and let the resurrection speak into that. On the other side of the debate, there is another fear. It's just the opposite question, and the fear is, what if it is true? What if Jesus of Nazareth really is the Son of God and is alive and is coming back someday? What will that mean for us? If that's true, then our autonomy is on the line. Our pursuit of happiness is in question. Life as we know it is at stake. And I think the disciples were asking all those kinds of questions as well. As the evidence of the resurrection came to those who went to the empty tomb, it brought about for them a whole new realm of unknowns. Yes, the death of Jesus was devastating, but death is something they know. They know what to do about death, and Mark seems to be making this point. Joseph of Arimathea requests the dead body, the corpse of Jesus, from Pilate so that it's not thrown in a common grave. And he wraps it and he puts it into the tomb. And the women follow him to the tomb to see where the body's laid, because as soon as they can, they're coming with spices to anoint the body. They want to prepare it for burial. Did you see how everybody's preoccupied with the work of death because they know about that? They know what to do. But when they get to the tomb, there's no body to be prepared. And Mark is just brilliant here. I think one of the reasons he gives us so much detail about these women is he wants us to see that they're close to Jesus. They were looking for him. They had seen him die. They had come up with him from Galilee. They were ministering to him. They had gone and see where his dead body was. They were coming back to prepare him. These women wanted to see Jesus, but it never crossed their mind that they would see him alive. Nobody was expecting this kind of resurrection, even though Jesus had told them that that's what he was going to do. Now, this is important because in the debate, one of the arguments is that people back then, people in ancient times, you know, they just didn't know better. They weren't as scientifically developed or informed as we are, and they were more apt to believe in the miraculous. That's why we have these stories of the resurrection of Jesus. But according to Mark, nothing could be further from the truth. They were taken aback by what was happening. They were terrified and afraid of what they discovered. When you consider the radical transformation of the early church, when you consider this developed, articulated theology they had of the resurrection, the reason that's important is because it takes so long to create a theology from scratch. And they had no conception of bodily resurrection in the present. Okay, so for that to happen that quickly, the most plausible explanation that historians can give is that they weren't creating a new doctrine, but that they were simply describing what they had seen and experienced. And even the way the story is written lends credibility to that. Mark has here, and several of the gospel writers have, women as the key eyewitnesses to the resurrection. The problem with that is that in this day, women, the testimony of women would not be admissible in court. And so if you were trying to write a story to give credibility to the fact that Jesus had risen from the dead, under no circumstance would you put women at the scene as your key witnesses. In fact, in the second century, there was a man named Celsus who made this his chief argument about how ludicrous the resurrection story is because there's women in it. Little did he know, he was only adding credibility to the historicity of this event. They were just describing what they saw. Jesus of Nazareth really died bodily. Jesus of Nazareth really was buried in a tomb. Jesus of Nazareth really rose bodily from the dead. So how did they get from fear to this developed theology, this faith in the risen Christ? Well, there's two kinds of fear. There's a fear that is paralyzing, and there's a fear that the Bible would describe as a fear of the Lord. It still has some elements of I'm scared in it, but there's also some elements of worship in it as well. You're not paralyzed, you're still enabled in the presence of God. As they came to the tomb, it was an unknown situation. It was a mystery. It meant that there was a world beyond what they could see, that they weren't in control, and that they didn't know what was going to happen next. That's always the effect of what happens when people come in the presence of the living God. They become immediately aware that they are not the center of the universe, and that they do not know what's going to happen next. They're not in control. And that's what happens to them. If God didn't speak, we would remain in that kind of paralyzed fear. This is what happens to the Roman guards. In Matthew's account, in Matthew 28, he tells us how the stone got rolled away. It's kind of a cool scene. He said, "Behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it," which is pretty cool. It's kind of sitting up there. "His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men." And so the Roman guards, the tough guys, are in fear, paralyzed, laying on the ground, not moving. This is where we would all be before God if he didn't speak to us, if he didn't reveal himself. But look in verse 4. Or verse 5, Matthew 28, "But the angel said to the women, 'Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He's not here, for he is risen as he said.'" So when the angels speak to the women, it doesn't take away their fear, but it does transform it into fear of the Lord. Eugene Peterson says, there's a kind of fear that incapacitates you to deal with God. That's the Roman soldiers. But there's also a kind of fear that awakens you, that pulls you out of your preoccupation with self and with your life and reveals to you the living God. And that is fear of the Lord. That's the women. They're still not in control. They still don't know what's going to happen next, but they have assurance that God is alive, and they worship him. When they come out of the tomb in Matthew's account, or maybe it's John's account, they run into the gardener, who is Jesus, but they don't know. But when they see that it's him, they fall to their knees, fear. But they reach out and touch him, worship. That's fear of the Lord. We do not like mystery. We do not like the unknown. As Americans, we like techniques and goals and metrics. We like to be in control. We do not know what to do with the living God. Earlier in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, before the children know about Aslan, Mr. Beaver begins to tell them that Aslan is on the move. And Susan asks, "Who is Aslan?" "Aslan," said Mr. Beaver. "Why, don't you know? He's the king. He's the lord of the whole wood. He'll put all things to right, as it says in an old rhyme in these parts. Wrong will be right when Aslan comes in sight. At the sound of his roar, sorrows will be no more. When he bares his teeth, winter meets its death. And when he shakes his mane, we shall have spring again. You'll understand when you see him." "But shall we see him?" asked Susan. "Why, daughter of Eve, that's what I brought you here for. I'm to lead you where you shall meet him," said Mr. Beaver. Is he a man?" asked Lucy. "Aslan, a man?" said Beaver. "Certainly not. I tell you, he's the king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who is the king of beasts? Aslan is a lion. The lion. The great lion." "Oh," said Susan, "I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "That you will, dearie, and no mistake," said Mrs. Beaver. "If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly." "Then he isn't safe?" said Lucy. "Safe," said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver's telling you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." If you have a conception of God that doesn't make you nervous, you have the wrong conception of God. He's the king of the wood. He's the great lion. But on the other hand, if you have a conception of God that makes you so nervous that you can't approach him, you don't have the right conception of God, because he's good. If you can think about all the things that are unknown in your life, that you stress about, that you worry about, would you be willing to let the risen Lord speak into those unknowns, even if it means not giving you the answers? I guess the question really beneath that is, do you believe that you can trust God? The resurrection answers that question with a resounding yes. Not because he's safe, but because he is so good. The prospect of seeing God brings another kind of fear to the surface, which is the question of, what will he do with me? Like, what if I look at him in the eye, what will he say to me? The resurrection says that he will say a word of grace. A word of grace that speaks to all kinds of fears, but perhaps most poignantly to our fear of rejection. I want you to notice this little detail back in Mark. Mark 16, verse 1. When the Sabbath was passed. Okay, so between the death of Jesus in Mark 15 and the resurrection of Jesus in Mark 16, you have the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day is a day of rest. It's a day when there is no work. And that doesn't mean you don't just go to work. It means you can't do anything. You're not supposed to exert any effort of any kind. It's a day to rest and remember God delivering his people from Egypt. That's the day between the death and the resurrection of Jesus. So after they had just seen their leader die and all their hopes flushed down the toilet, they're supposed to do nothing and remember God's faithfulness to his people. I do not imagine anybody was in the mood for either of those things on this Sabbath day. But there they are. Can't do a thing about it. The Sabbath is a word of grace. Before any work can be done, God is at work, bringing about resurrection in his Son. Before he speaks a word, before anybody sees him, grace is on the move. The Sabbath is also one of the reasons that Jesus got killed. It represents this deep conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders of the day. The Pharisees, who were the religious leaders, they viewed Sabbath keeping as a means of righteousness. I keep the law, and therefore God approves of me and accepts me. But Jesus preached that Sabbath keeping was really a means of grace. So on the one hand, you have the God of the Pharisees, who is on the side of the pious, those who keep the rules, and on the other hand, you have the God of Jesus, who is on the side of the brokenhearted and who saves the crushed in spirit. And the cross, in that context, seems to be a word about who wins that debate. Seems to be a final word that says, yes, the God of the Pharisees is the true God. Because Deuteronomy, the book of the law, says, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. Cursed by God. God of the Pharisees wins. But then the resurrection. You see, the resurrection, among other things, is a triumph of the God of grace over the God of the Pharisees. And even that kind of makes us uneasy. Because at least with the God of the Pharisees, we know what we're dealing with. We got rules, do the best you can, keep the rules, and prove yourself, and God will accept you in the end. I mean, the scales will weigh out. But grace is scandalous. Grace doesn't make any sense. I mean, the scales are weird because all of my sin gets put on Jesus and all of his righteousness gets put on me, not because of anything I've done. Grace was at work before I ever even thought about it. See, we don't like mystery. We don't like the uneasiness of not being able to prove ourselves. But the resurrection would say, all that needs to be proven has been proven in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The God of grace demands our whole life, not the cleaned up version, but as we really are. And if we are to come before God as we really are and look him in the eye, what's he going to say? Look what the angel says to the women. Verse 6. He said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he's going before you to Galilee." Peter. Okay, of all the people on the planet who do not want to look Jesus in the eye on this day, I got to think Peter's at the top of that list. Peter had, I don't know if the word is foolish or brave or a combination of both, had confessed his love for Jesus and said, "I will never fail you. I will never deny you. Even if it means death, I'll be at your side." Yet, on that night that Jesus was in the house and he was being mocked and unjustly accused, Peter's in the courtyard below and one of the girls down there recognizes him as one of the 12 and begins to ask him, and Peter says, no, that's not, I don't know him. And this wasn't just like, I didn't have time to think about my answer, and I said something stupid, I'd take that back if I could. He does it three times. Over and over and over, Peter denies knowing Jesus, even calls down curses upon him. So I don't think Peter wants to see Jesus. I don't think Peter thinks that Jesus wants to see him. And I think that's why he gets named here. I can envision the women going back to the fellas and saying, "Okay, the tomb was empty. An angel appeared to us, and he said, go tell the disciples to meet Jesus in Galilee." And I can see the disciples putting on a 20th century Bible study about word meanings. Like, wait a minute. When he said disciple, did he mean like the technical term, like the 12? Or did he mean like the real term, like those who love and follow Jesus? In other words, should we bring Peter or not? Right? We would get stuck on that. The whole mission would be exploded because we would be worrying about word meaning. And on this day, nobody got time for that. Jesus says, get Peter and bring him to Galilee. In John's version, when the women meet Jesus, he tells them, go to my brothers. I'm returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. This is covenant language. He's calling them brothers. Before he ever sees them, before he ever speaks a word to them, he calls them by name and he takes them into his family as brothers. Some of you have failed. Like you've blown it recently in your past, and you feel the fear of rejection from those that you've failed, your parents, your friends, your employer. Some of you feel it with God, that you have so failed him that you do not want to look him in the eye. I mean, what will he say to you? Tim Keller says that failure feels like a death, because it is. But if we would let our failure drive us to the gospel, in the gospel, death becomes a resurrection. If you would let your failure drive you to the risen Christ today, let him speak into that, you would hear him call you by name. You would hear him take you into his family as his brothers and sisters. A number of years ago at the church we were working at, there was a man in his 50s, who had just lived a hard life, made a lot of bad decisions, had that year left his wife. They hadn't divorced yet. The papers were in process, but he had moved out, left his four boys. He had had an affair. It was a train wreck. But he had started coming to our church and started to kind of get this sense of new life and like maybe God could put back together his life again. And he came in the office one day real excited about it and was asking me, hey, now that I'm kind of getting back on track, What kind of wife should I be looking for? And I said, to my knowledge, you have one. I think you should be looking for the one that you left. And he was like, what? Because he felt the fear of rejection. She had every reason in the book to reject him, to not take him back, to let him go. And I said, she probably should do that. But you've got to go back and beg, man. Get on your knees, confess, and ask her to take you back. And she did. And it wasn't easy. It was really hard. But he let his failure drive him to Jesus. And in Christ, he experienced new life. Not like a new and different life, but a renewed, restored life with his wife and with his boys. They're still together. Still hard, but they're walking in newness of life. How do you think Jesus sees you? Not today because you look pretty, but think about your moments of failure. Think about the shame that you carry with you and put yourself in that place. And do you envision Jesus welcoming you into the family, calling you by name, brother and sister? That's the grace of God toward you in Christ. That's what the resurrection speaks to you. And if you'll let that sink in, if you'll let that settle deep in your soul, then you'll know what John means when he says, perfect love casts out fear. That the one who fears has not been perfected in love. Because we love God because he first loved us. That's the grace of the gospel. The resurrection speaks a word of assurance. God is in control, and you can trust him. It speaks a word of grace. God accepts you, and you can rest in him. No more striving for righteousness. Finally, the resurrection speaks a word of power. God is renewing all things, and he is using us to do it. What does Jesus do with them in Galilee? He sends them out. It's interesting, when they come to meet him in Galilee, it says they all worshiped and some doubted. So even in that moment, they're all like, okay, you're alive, but what are you going to do with us? Right. He sends them out. He says, you're my people and you are the light of the world. Go make disciples of all nations. And when they hear that task, you know they're thinking, what? How are we going to do that? And he knows it. He knows they're afraid, and that's why he says, I'm with you. Don't be afraid. I'm with you until the end of the age. And when you look at the book of Acts, which is the next chapter in the story, the beginning of the church, what you see is a group of people who worship Jesus because they are obsessed with the resurrected Lord. They're in awe and wonder. You see a group of people who share life because they are convinced that they really are the family of God. You see a group of people who have such an impact on the world that you can't explain it apart from the supernatural power of God. These men who failed so badly became fearless leaders. They preached the gospel with boldness. They backed down to no one, even Peter. I mean, so Peter, the failure in Acts 2, there's so many examples, but listen to what Peter says here. God comes down in his spirit, does this incredible work. Everybody's trying to figure out what's going on, and Peter stands up to explain. And in his explanation, he says, this Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. But God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it. Attaboy, Peter. That's the guy who was backing down to the girl in the courtyard. With this group of men and with an early church consisting primarily of the poor and the outcast, Jesus begins his work of redemption and renewal in this world. There are all kinds of messianic movements, dozens of them. And they all had the same story. There was this swell of following, there was this energy behind it, but then the leader died and the movement fizzled out. This is the only movement that didn't fizzle. Not only did it not fizzle, it exploded. I mean, within 200 years, they had taken over the Roman Empire. Not to mention the worldwide effect that Christianity has had since then. So what's the difference between this movement and all the other messianic movements? In this one, the leader rose from the dead. That's really the only way to explain it. Jesus is risen. He is alive, he is with us, and we are agents of renewal in his new creation. We are the new humanity created in Christ for good works, which God has prepared in advance for us to walk in. I want to read you what I watched Ashley read that morning before school. At that moment, they heard from behind them a loud noise. A great cracking, deafening noise as if a giant had broken a giant's plate. The stone table was broken into two pieces by a great crack that ran down it from end to end, and there was no Aslan. "Who has done it?" cried Susan. "What does it mean? Is it more magic?" "Yes," said a great voice behind their backs. "It is more magic." They looked around. And there, shining in the sunrise, larger than they had seen him before, shaking his mane, stood Aslan himself. "Aslan!" cried both the children, staring up at him, almost as much frightened as they were glad. "Aren't you dead then, dear Aslan?" said Lucy. "Not now," said Aslan. "You're not a, asked Susan in a very shaky voice. She couldn't bring herself to say the word ghost. Aslan stooped his golden head and licked her forehead. The warmth of his breath and a rich sort of smell that seemed to hang about his hair came all over her. "Do I look it?" he said. "Oh, you're real. You're real, Aslan," cried Lucy, and both the girls flung themselves upon him and covered him with kisses. "But what does it all mean?" asked Susan when they were somewhat calmer. "It means," said Aslan, "that though the witch knew the deep magic, there's a magic deeper still which she did not know. Her knowledge only goes back to the dawn of time, but If she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. And now, yes, now, said Lucy, jumping up and clapping her hands. Oh, children, said the lion, I'm feeling my strength coming back to me. Catch me if you can. He stood for a second, his eyes very bright, his limbs quivering, lashing himself with his tail, and then he made a leap high over their heads and landed on the other side of the table. Laughing, though she didn't know why, Lucy scrambled over it to reach him. Aslan leapt again. A mad chase began. Round and round the hilltop he led them, now hopelessly out of their reach, now letting them almost catch his tail, now diving between them and tossing them in the air with his huge and beautifully velveted paws and catching them again, and now stopping unexpectedly so that all three of them rolled over together in a happy, laughing heap of fur and arms and legs. It was such a romp as no one has ever had except in Narnia. And whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or like playing with a kitten, Lucy could never make up her mind. And the funny thing was that when all three finally lay together, panting in the sun, the girls no longer felt in the least tired or hungry or thirsty. And now, said Aslan presently, to business. I feel I'm going to roar. You'd better put your fingers in your ears. And they did. And Aslan stood up, and when he opened his mouth to roar, his face became so terrible that they did not dare to look at it. And they saw all the trees in front of him bend before the blast of his roaring as grass bends in a meadow before the wind. And then he said, we have a long journey to go. You must ride on me. Jesus Christ is risen from the grave. And the new world of the resurrection is unknown, but we are known by the one who rules it. And we have taken up life with him in the work of renewing all things. We have a long journey ahead. I better cling to him.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.